This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, no quick fixes. It should have been a buoyant, even optimistic day. A brand new president bringing the people he considers to be the best and the brightest into his government. But as Barack Obama announced his new economic team in Chicago yesterday, he had a sobering message for Americans who were watching. No shortcuts, he warned. No quick fixes. It will get worse before it gets better. The president-elect also said he wants Congress to have an economic stimulus package ready to go by the time he's inaugurated on January 20th. Today, we're going to examine specifically how the new president would create those 2.5 million jobs in 2 years that he's promised, how much taxpayer money he'll have to spend to do it, and which job sectors would benefit most from a stimulus package. We'll also talk about his economic team. How will they complement each other? Who brings which talents to the administration? What does the addition this morning of Peter Orszag as head of the Office of Budget and Management mean? And we're going to talk about news from the Federal Reserve of the new purchases of mortgage-backed securities and the availability of $200 billion to open up the consumer credit market. Secretary of the Treasury Paulson is speaking at this hour. We'll include some of his comments in our conversation this morning. So we've asked a couple of guests to be with us for the hour. Stan Collender is Managing Director for Corvus Communications, and he writes a weekly column on budget issues for Roll Call. He's been a staffer on the House and Senate budget committees, and he joins us this morning from Washington. Stan Collender, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, an absolute pleasure.
Menzie Chin is with us as well. He's professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, co-author of the Econ Browser blog, and he's with us this morning from Madison. Professor Chin, always good to have you on the program.
Hi, Carrie. Glad to be here.
Stan Collender, I'm going to turn to you first. 2 weeks ago, the president-elect was saying, look, there's only one president at a time. My term doesn't start for a couple of months. Now he's holding two press conferences in 2 days to roll out his economic team and to talk about this stimulus package. What changed?
The economy changed, and the concerns about the economy grew, perceptibly. In addition, the current economic team, as much as it was involved before, basically checked out. Hank Paulson said just about 10 days ago that, I mean, he gave a speech at the White House press conference at the Treasury where he basically said, I've done all I'm going to do, and it's now up to the next president. The markets clearly didn't like that, and things were getting worse, so the new president clearly had to change strategies and get involved sooner than I think he probably would have preferred to do.
And do you think Treasury Secretary Paulson has also changed his posture on this? Because here he is this morning announcing more money for mortgage-backed securities and more money to get the credit market going again.
Well, unfortunately, the answer to that is yes. And I say unfortunately because it seems that the Secretary Paulson changes on if not a daily basis, and certainly a weekly basis on what he's going to do and when he's going to do it and how he's going to do it. So he gets up and doesn't inspire a great deal of confidence anymore that he's got control of the situation. And that's, to me, that was the most interesting thing about the president-elect's press conference yesterday. Clearly, he was trying to say we're going to get ahead of this instead of waiting for things to happen and us to respond. And that's what I think in large part the markets were responding so positively. And
Professor Chin, I thought Barack Obama walked an interesting line yesterday as he unveiled the team. He knows that he needs to give the markets, as Stan Collender is talking about, something to look forward to. And he knows that worried taxpayers are watching to see what he's going to do. But, you know, he's also very careful not to offer false hope, saying that there aren't going to be quick fixes, there are no shortcuts, and that ominous phrase of it's going to get worse before it gets better. Do you think he's serving both sides of this well?
Oh, well, absolutely. I think he's in an enviable position with respect to the economy. It's, just to reiterate the point, the situation's deteriorated very rapidly. If you look at how Wall Street forecasters have looked at the outlook for the economy, within the space of a month, it's drastically deteriorated. So there's no doubt in my mind and many people's minds that the challenges facing the economy are very large. Now, that being said, you don't want to rush into making commitments ahead of time before you've thought out about what's the optimal size of the package that you want to deliver and deliver it over what time period and how you want to allocate the stimulus to the economy. So, I think he's done the right thing by stressing here we are, where we've we know that there's a large problem. We're going to be proactive and ahead of the curve, and we've brought on board a team of people who are well-versed in, you know, how to handle situations like this as best as any of us are.
Are you as concerned as Mr. Colander appears to be about the performance of the Secretary of the Treasury, the inconsistency that we seem to be seeing?
Well, he too is in an enviable position. I think, you know, the situations have been changing very rapidly over the past month and a half, 2 months. You know, you do have to alter your positions about what works or what doesn't work. But it seems to me that he was a little too ready in saying, I'm finished, and then the situation has stabilized and no more funds need to be injected into the financial system. I don't think that was really a statement that was necessary and perhaps might have precipitated the subsequent turmoil.
Stan, I want to talk a bit about what the Treasury Secretary is announcing this morning and the money that's piling up. They're talking about billions and hundreds of billions more to try to get the credit market opened up and to come in and back these mortgage securities. These numbers are starting to seem so unrealistic because they're so huge.
Well, it's almost like playing with poker chips at this point. You lose any sense for what the value actually is. You know, these numbers are, I mean, you're exactly right. These numbers are so large that they wouldn't have dared show up in an economics text not that long ago, and they absolutely wouldn't have even shown up in a science fiction book because they were, you know, unbelievable until suddenly they became not just believable but necessary. I think the interesting thing is, and I need to hear obviously some more details, but it sounds to me like the Secretary of the Treasury today is announcing that he's going to do things that several weeks ago he said he didn't want to do, that is buy some assets. So it's you know, again, it's the kind of thing where you'd like to just believe that somebody is in charge. And I think, again, that's why the markets were responding positively when it looked like on Friday or so somebody, Tim Geithner, was going to take over, you know, or be proposed to take over, and that somebody new was going to be in charge and actually you'd get some fresh thinking.
Stan, is it all borrowed money?
Oh, I mean, you bet.
Every bit of it, mostly.
Every bit of it. And not only that, I mean, look, no one is arguing, at least I don't think, I haven't heard anyone say this, that we shouldn't do this. That is, that the sums are too big, we can't afford it, or that it's not worth the cost. But keep in mind that there will be a cost, that when the economy starts to recover, the aftermath will be, you know, a 20 or 25% increase in federal debt, annual interest payments that'll go up by, you know, $50 billion a year. And we're going to be paying for this for decades in one sense or another.
Professor Chin, what does that mean when we incur the kind of debt, when we've come through whatever this is, downturn, recession, and we're emerging? How does it hamstring what the government can do on the other side of this?
Well, I guess reiterating the point that there's no real choice about whether to do this or not.
Understood.
I guess what you need to think about are two sets of problems. You know, how do you unwind some of these purchases of assets that you've undertaken in this emergency period? That portion I'm not an expert on. It's much more financial, public management oriented than I'm familiar with. On the other hand, it does constrain the choices that you have in terms of fiscal policy for making purchases for government programs that we're more accustomed to thinking about.
Like healthcare or something like that.
Exactly, the healthcare investment in infrastructure. What that does is it places a premium on how we spend the money that we're going to spend on stimulus, you know, regardless of how you define the stimulus, if it's tax cuts or if it's spending in infrastructure. You want to make sure that the funds that you spend there are going to be well spent. That is, you get a, you know, big impact for each dollar spent, both at the short horizon and the long horizon.
Stan Colander, again with the caveat that, as you've pointed out and as Menzie Chin has pointed out, most people believe we have to do this. But do you think that, and I ask you this because you worked on House and Senate budget committees, that members of Congress and the incoming administration are facing the reality of what all this borrowing and these huge numbers are going to mean?
Oh, sure. At this point, I don't think there's any doubt about it. And it's actually been obvious since, oh, probably January of this year when we started talking about the first stimulus package. You know, there is a great deal of talk already on Capitol Hill among the people I talk with all the time that, all right, we understand what we have to do, but let's also discuss what's going to have to get done afterwards. That mm-hmm. is, and the president's hinted at that yesterday. President-elect, excuse me. He said, you know, we're going to be talking about a budget process that, you know, perhaps will be, and I don't know any details of it, but, you know, perhaps will be some way of getting back to the phrase deficit reduction. You know, that is, when we get through this, can we automatically trigger and set some goals in stone now, or at least in legislation, that will get us there, is to at least convince folks to lend us the money now because they'll be sure they'll get it back later.
Is that going to be part of Peter Orszag's role, and do you think he's the right man for the job at the Office of Budget and Management?
You know, I can't think of anybody who is better better qualified to do that job right now than Peter Orszag.
Wow, why?
Someone who, first of all, is totally immersed in the substance. There'll be no learning curve. And just as an example, by contrast, when Jimmy Carter came in, he picked a very qualified but untested, you know, budget person. That is Burt Lance, who was a president of a bank in Georgia. Burt Lance is very smart, but it took him months to get up to speed. Orszag doesn't have months. He has literally no time at all. And he's immersed in this. He knows health care. He knows Social Security, two of the biggest budget issues that are out there, knows where every dollar in that budget is buried, and, you know, will attract some great staff with him. I, as a budget person, I tell you, I couldn't possibly be happier with him being in that spot.
Stan Collender is one of our guests this morning as we talk about the details of the stimulus package that President-elect Obama has been working on. We got some idea of what he's headed for yesterday in a press conference where he unveiled the top leaders of his economic team. Again, this morning, holding another press conference at 11. You'll hear that on midday, at the beginning of the hour on midday, to announce that he has appointed Peter Orszag as head of the Office of Budget and Management. Peter, we've asked Stan Collender to be with us this morning to talk a bit about some of these appointments, to talk about the details of the stimulus package, and to talk about the news this morning that we're hearing from the Secretary of the Treasury's Managing Director for Corvus Communications, writes a weekly column on budget issues for Roll Call. We've also asked Menzie Chin to join us today. He's Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison and one of the co-authors of the Econ Browser blog. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're hearing all of this news coming at you, you have questions about it, I think we've got the guests who can answer it. 800-242-2828. If you're in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You reach us online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Stephen in Minneapolis. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. My question is, I heard Senator Dobbs say a few days ago that we've actually spent $5 trillion at this point at least. And can your guests, like, explain that breakdown of, like, where we would come up with $5 trillion?
You think that number is right, Stan?
You know, I have no reason to doubt the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, but my guess is, and I don't know the exact numbers, it's several different things. It involves a lot of what the Federal Reserve is doing, which is, Federal Reserve is an independent federal agency, so it's not included in the budget. It has the ability to spend money or provide loan guarantees and do a variety of things like that without congressional authorization or appropriations. So I suspect Senator Dodd is talking about a combination of the $700 billion TARP program, perhaps much of what's already in the federal budget itself, which is $2.3 trillion, and a variety of things the Federal Reserve is doing off budget.
Back to the phones to Al in Eden Prairie. Hi, your question.
Yes, I'm just wondering if we're ever going to unbury ourselves. I understand we're supposedly going to have a $10 or $11 trillion national debt. I mean, we're up to our eyeballs in hock to many developed countries, China, et cetera, the wealth funds, sovereign wealth funds and things like that. I don't think, you know, with the baby boomers retiring, that we're ever going to get out of debt. I mean, our goal sounds like it's just a really, the best we can ever hope for is to maybe possibly balance the budget, but we're living with this humongous debt that, do you think we're ever going to pay it off or even pay it down? I don't think so. What do you guys think?
Professor Chin, what do you think?
Well, first we need to make a distinction, you know, who's owing the debt. And, you know, for the federal government, there's one issue that is we were paying down the debt until 2001. And then, well, we had massive tax cuts in 01 and 03, which reversed that course. And now, of course, even more so reversing the course. You know, one thing to remember is a lot of the, going back to the previous question, a lot of what has been spent, quote unquote, is to purchase assets as opposed to spending on goods and services. And some of those assets may in the future turn out to be worth as much or more than they are right now.
So some of this money might come back.
I mean, you wouldn't want to gamble on it, but, you know, we are where we are, and it's possible. So, but the key point is that it's not spending in the sense that it's necessarily all gone. Some portion probably is going to be gone. Some of those assets will be worth less than what they were to begin with. Then there's the issue about, well, the federal government really never completely pays off the federal debt. What happens is over time, growth picks up, and if you've got responsible fiscal policy, you shrink the share of or the ratio of government debt to GDP. So that's one hope. You have a fiscal policy in the future which tries to average out or bring the budget deficit close to zero. Then there's the issue of what do we owe to the rest of the world. We've been lucky for the past few years that, you know, foreigners seem to keep on wanting to buy American assets and keep on losing on those purchases of American assets. That is, they lose value either because they disappear in value in dollar terms or the dollar loses value. And so if that can continue, then, you know, the problem is not as bad as it has been in the past. But your caller brings up a good point. We are kind of at the mercy of foreigners in terms of financing both the country's debt and the government debt.
As Stan, before you answer that, I just want to let you know a story crossing on the AP here says consumer confidence rose in November, kind of surprising, amid receding gas prices, but Americans' views on the economy remain the gloomiest in decades as they grapple with massive layoffs, slumping home prices, and dwindling retirement funds. I think we heard one of those callers there who's wondering about the strength of the overall economy and whose confidence seems to be shaken.
Well, I imagine that's October, not November results, since we're still in November. But the point is still exactly the same. It's not surprising. It's a little bit like being in a hurricane, an earthquake, and a tornado all at the same time.
Oh my gosh.
The ground is moving under your feet economically, and suddenly you know whatever you had saved isn't worth as much. Maybe nothing in some cases. Your house isn't worth as much. Your plans for retirement may have to be changed, or already have been changed. And at the same time, joblessness is increasing. So I would be shocked. Absolutely shocked if consumer confidence, wasn't shaken in general, even if it rose somewhat in October. I have a question for Professor Chin. You mentioned that we were paying down some of the debt. I'm haunted by the idea that both when Bill Clinton left office and George Bush came into office, we had talked about paying off the national debt essentially by about now, the end of this decade. If that had happened, if we had managed to do that, Wouldn't this situation, that is the need for big government response to a crisis situation, have been much less debilitating for the economy? That is, the bond market probably would have welcomed the additional supply of government borrowing coming on the market, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. I think in this arena, we're certainly in sympathy. It does seem like one of the great tragedies of modern macroeconomic history that we pushed through tax cuts in 01 and 03, especially in 03, that worsened the fiscal outlook for the country. So exactly at this point in time, we don't have the fiscal ammunition to fight a problem like this. I've always said that we've got our hands tied behind our back exactly at the time we need both hands to be available to pull the economy out of a recession, and a deep recession, perhaps the deepest since the Great Depression.
Professor Chin, do you look mainly at you've mentioned the tax cuts a couple of times. We know that there has been a lot of additional spending on homeland security and two wars that the country is fighting, but you seem to be looking mostly at the tax cuts for some of the debt that we find ourselves in coming into this financial meltdown?
Well, for sure, the fiscal restraint was lacking in the past 8 years. But I think if you do a breakdown, I think Stan Collender probably knows these numbers even better than I do. If you look at the breakdown and how much revenue was lost from the tax cuts versus how much was, how much of the accumulation of debts attributable to, let's say, the war in Iraq is $140, $150 billion a year. That's big, especially after you accumulate it over year after year. But still, it's not as big as the component that's coming from the tax cuts.
Stan Collender, how would you break that down?
You know, I don't know the exact numbers. It was a $5.6 trillion tax cut over 10 years. So it was, you know, it was not insignificant by any means. And, you know, I mean, again, let's go back to the word I used, the sin here, and I'm using it very intentionally, is that there never was a $5.6 trillion surplus. It was projected, and we ended up doing a tax cut based on a projection that was unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And now we're paying for it. As I said, you know, I've got to believe that at some point the Chinese, the Japanese, and everybody else who lends us all this money is going to say, if not no mas, then not as much. And that's got to force interest rates up in this country.
Is that what happens? If that occurs, if they're saying we're not lending you as much as we have in the past?
Well, this is a great question for Professor Chin, but let me give you, this is not a theory. In 2005, the South Koreans, a relatively low-level official in South Korea, announced that they were thinking about diversifying their holdings of sovereign debt, which essentially means we're going to buy something other than U.S. debt, and interest rates spiked in this country within seconds. Now, eventually, it stabilized, as in later that afternoon, when a higher-level official in South Korea announced that, we were misconstruing the word, diversify. They meant diversifying the maturities of U.S. debt. But still, the lesson was learned, and that was 3.5 years ago by a relatively small buyer of U.S. debt.
Professor Chin, what happens if the foreign money holders say, we'll still lend, but we're not going to lend on the scale that we have been?
Well, I think Stan's got exactly the logic right. We've been sort of teetering on this on the top of a peak where it seems like you wonder why so many actors in the world economy are willing to lend to the United States at the terms
that it has. I have wondered that. What's the answer?
And to some extent, there's not much of an alternative. For so long, you would hear this mantra that American capital markets were so deep that the American government bond market was so large and liquid that there weren't many alternatives for holding, let's say, euros or assets in euros and other currencies, pounds and so forth. Now the American capital market doesn't look so fantastic, and these central banks, as well as other hedge funds and so forth, have made losses year after year after year. You wonder when they're going to say we've got enough of these assets, especially as the U.S. government dumps many, many, many more U.S. treasuries onto the market. It may be that eventually, there's going to be the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, the saving grace, if you can call it that, is if all the other countries in the world have to undertake similar operations and borrow as much at the same time, well, then it's kind of a race. You've got other countries trying to borrow at the same time, and foreign investors might still decide to go with the U.S. dollar. But you can see it's a big risk. You're really rolling the dice. And we have been rolling the dice for years and years, and perhaps now we're possibly going to lose big. It is one of those things that has puzzled international finance economists for a long time. Why is it that especially foreign central banks have been willing to buy so many U.S. assets?
800-242-2828 to join our conversation. We're talking this morning about some of the details that are coming out about the stimulus package that Barack Obama outlined. More details to be filled in about that. But after the newscast, we're going to dig into some of the specifics on that. How does the federal government actually create 2 million, 2.5 million jobs? Does the money flow out of the federal government to states? Who actually ends up getting those jobs? We'll talk about that as well. And we're taking a look at some of the news that's breaking right now. The Treasury Secretary is speaking this morning in Washington, and he's outlining the framework for putting more money into buying up some of these mortgage securities and trying to get more money into the credit market. So we're talking about that as well. And we're going over some of the details of the team that Barack Obama announced yesterday. A call here, and then we'll go to news, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation to Amanda in St. Paul. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good morning.
Your question.
Yes. I have been hearing with each big money step in response to the economic downturn that each step has been called imperative, and it's been marketed, at least, that we don't have a choice whether or not to spend, say, $700 billion at a time to respond. And I'm wondering if you could help me understand why it's imperative that we keep spending in, as you're saying before, numbers that seem almost unreal.
Right. Stan, take a whack at that, will you?
Well, there's several different things. I know I'm sounding a little tongue-tied here. Every step along the way, it sounds imperative because for both political and economic reasons, or at least that's the judgment that's being made. When the Bear Stearns situation happened, there was a concern about a meltdown on Wall Street because one firm was going to go down. The same thing was said about Citigroup over the weekend, too big to fail, and the same thing was, of course, said about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I mean, let me be honest with you. The truth is we don't know. Nobody alive, or at least nobody in a position of power at the moment, has ever been through anything like this before, and I'm not sure anybody has ever been through anything like this before. So everyone's a little bit flying by the seat of our pants. The problem is that everyone's worried that if they don't do something, they will have made the wrong choice. And so that from a political perspective, it is always better at this point to err on the side of doing more rather than less. And the word crisis or have to act is used for political and messaging purposes rather than, it's not based in theory because, as I said, we've never really been here before.
Stan, just a quick note here before we go to news. You're hearing more and more second-guessing on the decision about Lehman Brothers to go ahead and let it fail. And you're hearing people say, I don't think there would have been such a trigger had Paulson decided to step in and save Lehman. Do you believe that?
Oh, that's revisionist history. That might be correct. It might not be. But you know what? It's too late.
They made that decision.
Let's move on.
Okay. Let's move on. We'll take a break for news, and when we come back, continue our conversation, talk about some of the details of this jobs stimulus package that President-elect Obama has been talking about. To join us, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And if you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, you can always reach us online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question to the Newsroom. And Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Gary, the nation's gross domestic product shrank by 0.5% in the third quarter, the worst decline since a nearly 1.5% fall back in 2001. It's also a big departure from the economy's 2.8% growth in the second quarter this year. The Fed will buy up to $600 billion in mortgage-backed assets in another attempt to deal with the financial crisis. Fed also announced it'll lend up to $200 billion to the holders of securities backed by various types of consumer loans. Stocks are extending their advance for a third day. With the economy in turmoil, President-elect Barack Obama wants Congress to pass a big economic recovery plan, one he says is significant enough that it really gives a jolt to the economy. With tax cuts and job creation measures, it could run around $500 billion. A Defense Department official says Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, is being transferred from Guantanamo Bay back to his home country of Yemen. A Yemeni official says the news surprises him since Hamdan wasn't due to be released until January. Michael Vick has pleaded guilty to state dogfighting charges in Virginia. It's a plea deal aimed at getting the former Atlanta Falcons quarterback a suspended sentence and a year of probation. The 2009 fleet of cars and trucks from Ford and its Volvo subsidiary have 16 vehicles on the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety's list of the safest new cars. The whole list has 72 vehicles, more than double last year's total. North Dakota motorists are bucking the trend of being on the road less than usual. The Federal Highway Administration says American motorists drove nearly 11 billion fewer miles in September than they did in the same month last year. Only North Dakota showed an increase in driving for the month. Mostly sunny skies for the state of Minnesota today. High temperatures around 40 in southwestern Minnesota, upper 20s in the Arrowhead. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's partly sunny. The temperature is 21. It's 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Enjoy a holiday night out with an acoustic Christmas from the Steele family. These amazing brothers and sisters perform gospel music that's soulful, stylish, and sensational. The annual tradition continues Friday and Saturday nights, December 12th and 13th. Minnesota Public Radio invites you to the Fitzgerald Theater for the Steele family. Call the Fitzgerald box office for tickets, 651-290-1221.
Support for this program comes from REI, providing outdoor adventure gear and apparel for camping, hiking, and cycling, and caring for outdoor spaces since 1938, in stores and at REI.com.
Today's programming is supported by Travelers, leader of the Travelers Education Access Initiative, a collaboration of business, college, and community organizations working together to help make college and career success a reality for low-income first-generation students.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Boy, we have some great shows planned for this holiday week. Just let me give you a little taste of what we've got coming up today and then through Thanksgiving and then through Friday. Today, Minnesota author Julie Schumacher is in the studio with us. Her young adult novel called Black Box has been getting a lot of national attention. She's written about teens and depression. We'll talk about how the fiction came out of her real-life experience as a parent. And she'll read some excerpts from the novel. Should be a great conversation. That's today at 10. Tomorrow at 10, the broadcast of my Talking Volumes conversation last week with Wally Lamb. Boy, we had a standing room only crowd at the Fitzgerald Theater. He was fantastic. Terrific music. We just didn't want to let the evening end. So we've managed to get it into an hour. And you'll hear the broadcast of that hour tomorrow at 10. If you want to hear some of the audience Q&A and some of the things that we couldn't fit in to the conversation, to the edited version of the conversation, you can find that online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Then, the Friday after Thanksgiving, my hour-long conversation with Joan Baez. Wonderful. We talked about what it was like to be the icon of a generation. We talked about what it was like for her to experience the intense stage fright that she did, what it was like to confront the fact that she might lose her voice, and this triumph of touring again after 50 years of performing. I also played some of her music, and I played some of her other favorite artists, including Pete Seeger. You've got to hear what she had to say when she heard Pete Seeger sing Turn, Turn, Turn. So that is Friday at 10 o'clock, the day after Thanksgiving. Joan Baez. You'll find our whole schedule online on the Mid-Morning page at minnesotapublicradio.org. Back to our conversation this hour with our guest. Menzie Chin is one of our guests this morning. He's professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. Stan Collender joins us this morning, managing director for Corvus Communication. You'll find a weekly column that he writes on budget issues for Roll Call, and had a long experience on Capitol Hill as a staffer on the House and Senate budget committees. Gentlemen, I want to talk a bit about the details of this job stimulus package that the president-elect is talking about before we go back to the phones. And Professor Chin, to you first, tell me about the mechanics of how something like this works. When President-elect Obama says he wants to create 2.5 million jobs in 2 years, I know that the federal government begins to spend money to do this, but where does it go from there?
Okay, well, there actually could be two main ways, I guess. One way would be by tax cuts, and the other would be by spending increases on government programs. Let me talk about, let's say, if the spending was to go into building a bridge.
Because that's what he's talking about, right?
That in part. Although, you know, going back to your question, you know, what are the details? And we have precious few of those right now. Maybe that's intentional, or maybe they're still working those things through. But suppose we take, for example, building a bridge. Now, and suppose the project was ready to run. Let's say, you know, it all been planned out. The government could disperse the money to whatever entity was going to build the bridge. Those construction workers who might not otherwise be working would be then employed. You'd have to buy the supplies, materials, and so forth.
Okay.
All those would be direct spending right away by the government, and that would go into GDP calculations right away, so dollar for dollar. Now, you know, that doesn't seem like much, but then, you know, it's clear that when you've spent to build the bridge, well, the workers have been working, they're paid, they're going to go out and presumably spend some proportion of what they've received in income, you know, after the taxes and after they decide what to save, the rest will be spent. That becomes, that spending is part of GDP. So if they go to the grocery store, they go to the retail store, they're going to be spending on goods and services there. That goes into GDP. That's going to employ the workers at those establishments.
So
those people there are going to have income.
So it filters out through the economy. But tell me this. If the federal government undertakes this the way we've just talked about, does the money get appropriated, let's say, to the state of Minnesota, who has some of these infrastructure projects on the books? And I know the state of Minnesota does have that. Does the money come through the state and they decide how to allocate it or what?
Well, I think that's one of the big things that has to be decided. And it's part of the debate about how to get the money, the resources to be spent most efficaciously. When you want the stimulus, you want it to be, in the words of, I believe, Peter Orszag, timely, targeted, and temporary.
Okay.
You want this these funds to be spent at a time when you need them, like when you're in a recession, and it looks like we're pretty deep into one and going into a deep one. You want them to be targeted. You want to spend the resources on you want to spend the money on factors of production, people, companies that aren't going to be employed otherwise, and to have that then recirculate into the economy in the way I just mentioned. And then, you know, you want these programs to end when the need for them ends, that is, after the recession. So keeping those things in mind, then there's decision how do you operationally get that money into the economy. And if you, you know, try to have the federal government do it right now, starting from ground up to say, oh, let's identify a project, let's plan it, let's build it, it could take a long time.
Take too long. Okay.
Now the question then is, how do you allocate the money to the states? And the states have a lot of projects that are probably ready to roll.
Right.
We don't know exactly how much. I saw one estimate of $20 billion worth of state highway projects ready to go. That's still not the $300 or $400 or $500 billion that number that's been bandied about, but you know, there are probably other projects. If you can give it to the states who already have these things in the works, then possibly things could proceed faster. But I don't know how the Obama administration to be is planning to disperse the money.
Stan Collender, how does this sound to you in the stages that it's in right now, and knowing that we'll get more detail about it as it goes on?
Well, look, that's only going to be one component of what we've been told will be job creation, and the professor is exactly right. It takes some time to get infrastructure spending out, but, you know, it has simply because you got to send the money to the states. The states probably don't have contractors ready to go for specific projects, but just in anticipation of that, some of them might start hiring and doing a variety of things to get ready. But the other aspect of this in terms of getting jobs is going to be a pretty substantial tax cut for what the president-elect says will be 95% of taxpayers. And that may not, you know, when you say a substantial tax cut, understand that it could be around $1,000 per person, which is not anything to sneeze at, but it's not going to allow you to buy a car or a home.
Right.
Right? But, you know, if taxpayers in anticipation of this tax cut, if the president announced it today, for example, started to spend a little more at Christmas time, obviously the stores would, you know, would be able to get rid of some of their inventory, hire back some of the people they may have laid off in anticipation of slow sales. So it's one of those things where it, you know, it has a multiplier effect that takes some time to work its way through the economy.
You think 2.5 million jobs is ambitious enough given the number of jobs that have already been lost and will be lost in 2009?
You know, I think the president-elect is doing something that's smart, and that is he's trying to manage expectations. You know, he did that from the beginning with his first press conference where he said, there's only one president at a time. I'm not going to be able to, and don't expect me to take over right this second. And then yesterday he did it again by saying this is going to take some time. You know, one of the things with the economy is that it's not just substantive, and it's not just dollar bottom line based. It's also economic, psychological, as we've seen with the market. So, would I prefer that it be more than 2.5? Yes. Do I think it can be and will be more than 2.5? Yes. But you know, the president is trying to manage properly, and that's not insignificant. That's actually pretty important, because one of the things he's got to do, don't forget, he hasn't even started off, he hasn't even been sworn in yet, is to build political capital over time, and that to the extent that he can show people that he's achieved what he promised, or maybe done better, he will have more political capital to do some of the tougher things that are a little bit further down the road, as we discussed about a half hour ago, for example, cutting spending.
Okay. To the phones, to Scott in Woodbury. Hi, Scott. Thanks for waiting.
Thanks, Carrie. Another excellent program. I'm just wondering, if I got this right, if all these derivatives that can't be valued now because of the questions about the underlying securities that support them, wouldn't all this money be better spent by shoring up those subprime loans or consumer loans that represent the trillions in derivatives? Wouldn't that have been a better use of all these funds from the beginning?
Yeah. Stan Colander, how about you?
No, I'm going to throw that one over.
You're
to
throwing
professor.
That to Professor Chen? Yeah. All right, Professor, what do you think?
Well, I think there's arguments for that. I you know, they go both ways. Probably, well, first of all, it's essential, I think, to try to get the markets for these asset-backed securities moving again. So, I don't think if it's an either or. On the other hand, you know, I think there's been a sort of traffic jam on trying to get some sort of workout for these subprime loans.
Meaning what?
Well, that there's not been an agreement on Capitol Hill with the current administration, and so or even within the administration, Sheila Bair came out with she's the head of the FDIC, came out with a plan. And apparently couldn't internally get agreement on with the rest of the administration, in particular with Treasury, on going forward with her plan to do essentially workouts for the mortgages and trying to cut down the cost to the mortgage holders and so forth with some guarantees by the government. You know, part of the reason is it's, you know, maybe philosophical. Part of it is it would have been expensive. And then part of it is this question about should you be rewarding people who took out these subprime mortgages, which a lot of people view as, you know, having been irresponsible behavior, and now we're going to bail out those people who were irresponsible. That's not my argument, but I think that's a view of a lot of people out there, and that explains part of the resistance. So, you know, how you come down upon this this issue depends upon, in part, your view about, you know, who should bear the burden for making these decisions about getting the subprime mortgages.
Professor, just another question real quick about this jobs before we go back to the phones. Mm-hmm. How closely does what he's talking about, again, knowing more details are going to get filled in, resemble what Roosevelt did with the WPA?
Well, let's see. I can't claim to be an economic historian. I'd say that you know, public works was one of the biggest identifiable things of the programs implemented in the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So the infrastructure component seems like something that's quite similar. On the other aspects, I can't say that I can, you know, say exactly how it matches up.
8 million jobs, I think, created. Stan Colander, do you know anything about that, or should we save that for another day?
Let's save it for another day.
All right. We'll have you back, and you'll
study in between. Thank you for the option, though.
for giving you an out on that. To the phones, to Ann in St. Cloud. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Let me switch off my speakerphone.
Okay.
Okay. I would like, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I would like your guest comment on an economic stimulus proposal. Given that we've got every college-educated person from age 20 to about age 50 in this country paying anywhere from hundreds to thousands of dollars a month in student loans, what if we did a refundable tax credit, kind of like the EITC, that would just pay those student loan payments? That would shore up housing demand, it would stimulate consumer demand, and it wouldn't reward any irresponsible behavior. I think that would be the best economic stimulus plan we could do.
Who thinks that's a good idea? Professor Stan Colander?
Well, let me just a couple of things off the top of my head, and obviously I haven't studied this at any great length. First of all, I'm not sure who actually has student loans anymore, or whether those are the people who need the help. Second, I don't know whether that would actually do much for Wall Street and the and in terms of getting credit going again. You know, it's and on top of everything else, those are relatively low interest loans, and I'm not sure it would have, you know, it paying those off makes the most sense. If you're going to do something like that, there are probably many more people with mortgages, you know, that you know might need some help, especially as unemployment goes up. Professor?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, if you're thinking about stimulus and you're thinking about stimulus specifically, I think you want to think about helping the people who are most impacted by the current recession. You know, how squeezed are they by not being able to get a job, or they're losing a job, or their hours are being cut back. And I'm not sure that group includes those with completely with student loans. And you also want it to affect those who have the, you know, what we call the highest marginal propensity consume. That is, you know, when they get a dollar's worth of assistance, either explicitly or implicitly through a reduction in their interest payments, you want them to spend most of those benefits now, as so that it goes through that recirculation or that multiplier process that I discussed before.
Yeah, Professor,
I wonder, can I ask a follow? Can I ask a follow-up question? Anne, do you have a student loan?
Yes, I do. I pay about $530 a month in student loan payments, and pretty much everybody my age that I know does. And the younger they are, the more they owe.
Yeah, you know,
I the same people who would be buying houses if they could afford them, but they have to pay their student loans first.
Well, and I got to tell you, someone who paid back every penny of a student loan personally, they should pay it back, obviously. But you know, look, if the choice is getting money into your hands, then I'm not sure paying off or getting money into the economy, I'm not sure paying off student loans is going to do it. You know, and then there's a we haven't used the phrase, but it's called moral hazard. That is the question: if we pay off all these student loans here, then is there an expectation that it'll happen again? You know, so or those people who don't have student loans, who this professor says might need the money more. I mean, in other words, it's an interesting question and I understand an issue, but I'm not sure it's the absolute best way to make this happen.
Yeah, Professor Ann's question also reminds me of a conversation we were trying to have yesterday. We had a lot of technical problems, so we didn't really spend as much time on it that we wanted to. And this is the president-elect's proposed program, again, more details to follow, about more affordability and more accessibility for college students. I ask you about this because, of course, you teach at UW-Madison. And when I look at the price tag for something like that, and then you add in the health care and so much of the other proposals, when you look at the way the numbers are adding up, is it fair to say to American voters who are waiting for some kind of relief on student loans or whatever it is, that the wait is going to be longer than they might have first expected because of what's going on with the economy?
Well, I think we do have to prioritize, and you know, saving the economy is going to indirectly help out the schools in terms of their ability to fulfill their mission. I mean, teaching at a state university, you're very cognizant of the fact that, you know, your operating funds and so forth are dependent upon tax revenues that come through the state, and hence the state's economy definitely impacts upon, you know, the availability of education and the ability of the state to, you know, provide the services for the students. So I think indirectly, you know, if you can help out the economy, then you can help out the students. But there is this longer-term problem that the cost of education is rising faster than the, you know, general price level. And students, I've seen it over the years that I've been teaching, have to work more and more, you know, and that takes away from their ability to do their studies well.
Right.
And so I think, you know, for a variety of reasons, including the fact that we know that higher education yields a pretty high payoff to society, I think, you know, we'll have to wait a little bit, but I think the Obama campaign or the administration has in mind the right thing is to put this pretty high up on the priority list, exactly because it's important for the economy's long-term prospects.
Stan, since you worked on Capitol Hill, tell me how quickly you think this stimulus package that the president-elect was talking about yesterday and we'll talk about again today can actually get done. He wants it ready to go, I guess, by January 20th, the day he's inaugurated. Can it happen?
Yes, in fact, I think it will, unless he comes up with something that is so totally, you know, out of left or right field, depending upon your view in life, that it's just not, you know, just cannot be done politically. But if there was one message from this campaign, if there was, you know, one thing that the president-elect got a mandate to do, that was fix the economy. He's now got a substantial Democratic majority in both houses, including perhaps the Minnesota race. Who knows? And Congress is looking at the election results, saying, okay, the one thing he's been asked to do, and we've been told we have to do, is deal with the economy, and we're going to let him. I suspect Republicans and Democrats alike are going to vote pretty much, you know, to give him what he wants early on.
And they can get it done that quickly, huh?
Oh, sure. Look, I remember Aid for New York City back in the 70s was done in a couple of days when it was necessary. Typically what happens is Congress comes in the first week in January and then leaves for 2 weeks. This time Congress is going to come back I think, on January 6th. And my guess is they're going to work for 2 weeks. They will already have the draft of the legislative language of the president's proposals. We'll make relatively minor changes in it, and the president will get pretty much what he wants. It's not inconceivable that on Inauguration Day he could end up signing this.
Wow.
It's also not – I mean, that would be pretty dramatic and a great photo op. But, you know, if it was a couple of days later, that would still be light speed by congressional standards.
And do you worry at all that the complexity of this and the size of this argues that it should not be rushed? Or are we in a time when that doesn't matter as much as the need to just get something else going?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I think doing something is probably more important here than getting it precisely right. As we've seen with the TARP program, the Paulson, you know, bailout program, there are ways to make some adjustments along the way. But I don't think this is going to be that complicated. You know, you're going to have a tax cut. You're going to have some spending increases on the stimulus, on infrastructure, as we've already discussed. Maybe a couple of other things having to do with Medicaid and aid to the states, and not much beyond that. And under those circumstances, that limits the number of committees that will consider it, which is important when you're trying to move things along in Congress, you know, makes it simple and makes it easy to actually start to implement and execute.
Stan Collender, Menzie Chin, both of you, I hope you'll come back. Thank you so much for the time this hour. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary.
Stan Collender, Managing Director for Corvus Communications, writes a weekly column on budget issues for Roll Call and has a lot of experience on Capitol Hill with budget issues. He was a staffer on the House and Senate Budget Committees. Menzie Chin is an infrequent guest with us, but always good to call on him. He teaches economics and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and you can read some of the things that he's been writing about the economy at the Econ Browser blog. At 11, you'll hear Barack Obama's remarks. Again today, a press conference out of Chicago. He's going to officially name Peter Orszag as head of the Office of Budget and Management, but also make some remarks about some of the other details of his stimulus package that he and his transition team are putting together. At 10 o'clock, we talk with writer and creative writing professor Julie Schumacher. She teaches at the University of Minnesota. She's out with a new novel for young adults. What a great read. It's called Black Box. It's about what happens in a family and what happens in the relationship between two sisters when the eldest sister experiences a pretty serious bout of depression and is actually hospitalized. Really great read. She'll read some excerpts from it. We'll talk about Julie Schumacher's own experience and how she drew from that in her fiction writing. On Wednesday at 10, more great writers. Wally Lamb was with us at the Fitzgerald Theater last Thursday night. We had a capacity crowd there. Boy, he is just absolutely terrific. Actually, he's taught creative writing for years, now teaches it in a prison. A women's prison. We talked about his experience there, why he believes that experience of being a teacher has made him a better writer. We talked about what he went through. It's been 9 years since he published his last novel, and what he went through to bring so many different themes and ideas together in this new novel called The Hour I First Believed. If you want to hear some of the Q&A from the audience, you can find that, I hope, by today online on the Talking Volumes page at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. But I hope you'll listen. If you did not have a chance to be in the audience on Thursday night, I hope you'll listen in on Wednesday at 10. And then I'm really excited about the interview with Joan Baez. You'll hear that in full, lots of music, on Friday at 10. This is Mid-Morning.
Programming is supported by Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, committed to helping families be successful homeowners, believing that homes and families are the foundation to successful communities. More at tchabitat.org.
This is Minnesota Public Radio News, and you're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.